Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. Ralph is away this week, gadding between the finest restaurants and rugby stadiums of France in a camper van. So you're stuck with me, John Hay, Corporate Finance and Sustainability Editor.
And me, Mike Turner, Corporate Bonds Editor.
Now, it's been a curious week in the market, not one for great totemic deals or even terrible crashes, but a week that felt significant, perhaps even a turning point.
Yes, we're once again left looking at rates and what central banks are doing. And there have been some unexpected developments there that have sent different markets spiraling in different directions. The US Federal Reserve left its interest rates unchanged on Wednesday, which has sort of sparked a hope that we might be at the end of the rate rising process. At the same time, the Bank of England did the same thing. But last week, the European Central Bank raised its rates by 25 basis points. So there's a divergence between what the central banks are doing after, you know, months and months of them raising their interest rates to try and combat inflation. So this has created a sort of at the end is near messaging. And as our SSA editor, Addison Gong, wrote this week, it hasn't really gone over in the market like that. The sort of knock-on effect in the market hasn't been a sigh of relief. 10-year US Treasury yields jumped up to levels not seen in more than 16 years.
So you mean the rates are still, in a way, rising, even though ought to be the top?
Yes, exactly. And I think what it comes down to is belief. Because there's this mixed message, and then the sort of famous press conferences that the central banks have after they do all their business, has given the implication that rates are just going to be higher for longer, for much longer than people thought. So rather than, you know, the wave cresting and then falling back down, it's just going to stay higher for a much longer time than expected.
So everyone's been looking forward to this moment, haven't they, for a long time, months, if not even longer, the point when rates finally top out and we sort of get to the top of the hill. Now it's a bit like when you're climbing a mountain or something in Scotland, or you know, you think you've got to the top, and then there's always a little bit more that just sort of suddenly comes into view. Is that the main worry for the market, do you think, that they could go still higher?
I think potentially they could go higher, but I think the real worry is that they're going to stay here for a long time. We've had, you know, years of very cheap debt, and it's very quickly got more expensive. And at the point it's at now, there's talks about how sustainable it is in various parts of economies, you know, particularly in the lower rated end of the spectrum, where companies are having to refinance way more costs than they've had to pay for a long, long time. And that's going to impact bottom lines. And that sort of stuff filters through, you know, and then there's the worry that if rates stay at this level for a very long time, it's going to have, you know, real world effects and real knock-on effects.
And of course, the mortgage market is the sort of sleeping giant here, isn't it? And we haven't really seen yet the pain in the mortgage market that normally follows every time there's an interest rate rising cycle.
Yes, so when in the mortgage market, when people come to refinance, they're probably going to find that rates are still very high. So you'll have people holding off, you know, buying houses or refinancing their mortgages, hoping that the rates will come down. But inflation is still way above central bank targets. So, you know, rates are going to be at this level for a long time. So it's more the shift, I suppose, has moved more from how high the rates are going to get, this, you know, it's called the terminal rate, and instead how long they're going to stay at this level.
Now, Mike, in the SSA market, the public sector bond market, the concerns are slightly different, aren't they? The entities there, the governments, the government agencies and the supranational bodies like the World Bank and the European Union, they don't have any worries about defaulting because of high interest rates. But the problem for them is more how to finance themselves most efficiently. And they've been finding it rather a difficult market, haven't they, in the last few weeks?
They have. So in the SSA market, because they are so well rated and so well regarded, they actually they get hit worse really by volatility in the rates market because they trade so close to rates. So any moves there directly impacts their spread very, very clearly. And what's been happening in the SSA market is some issuers have been having to accept that their deals maybe aren't going to fly off the shelves as they used to. There have been deals that haven't issued book updates. Some of the smaller SSA issuers, and you know, it's a very wide-ranging market. You've got the European Union with, you know, 100 billion plus euros a year issued, and then you have states in Germany which will issue a fraction of that. And this week the city of Bremen was out with a deal, and it didn't produce a book update during the process of marketing the deal when the books were open. And what that means is usually if a deal's going well, your syndicate banks rather will tell the market, oh, we've got this much in orders, you know, we want a 500 million deal and we've got 2 billion in orders, look how well we're doing. And Bremen didn't issue a book update, and the thinking behind that is that it just shows that there's this level of uncertainty in the market and weaknesses that are coming to show because of people not being 100% sure of where rates are going.
Yeah, so this sort of rates uncertainty has been dogging the market, especially in euros, hasn't it, for some weeks. And, so what everyone in the SSA market was looking forward to was clarity and certainty on rates, which they hoped to get from the ECB last week and from the Fed. And both of those events ought to have calmed the market. But do you think it has?
No, it doesn't seem like it has at all. And it's because, you know, there's a few elements at play here. The sort of hard numbers and the divergence now between the ECB and the Fed, with the ECB raising its rate and the Fed holding still. But then also with the language used, you know, the language is a much harder thing to pick apart than, you know, looking at the cold hard fact of a 25 basis point rate rise. But the language used really sort of implies that rates are going to be a lot longer than people expected.
So what are SSAs going to have to do to cope with these conditions?
Well, you know, money talks, so a higher new issue concession is going to be the sort of number one thing that SSAs will have to do. But the difference between a SSA issuer and nearly every other issuer we cover is that SSA shareholders really are taxpayers. So they have that sort of added incentive to keep costs as slim as possible. And, you know, that then makes this tension between issuers and investors really come to the fore.
So the financial institutions bond market, of course, as well, is also coping with the same situation.
Yeah, and they have a little bit more space in their spreads, don't they, than the SSA market. So tell us, John, what's been happening there?
Yeah, so the FIG market, as it's called, has actually been on fire. It's been having a tremendous September. The first half of the month was great. Conditions were really good. Issuers issued a lot of paper in Europe. But the second half has got even better. And it's curious that the people who work in that market often sit, you know, just yards away from those in the SSA market or the corporate market. They're on the same trading floors. This is the investment banks, of course. At the investment firms as well, they're often, you know, they're in the same general divisions. But yet the way they interpret what's going on can be so different.
So how are investors in the FIG market interpreting it?
Well, the interesting thing is they seem to be very reassured by what the European Central Bank said last week. They're quite gung-ho about believing that Christine Lagarde, when she announced the 25 basis point interest rate rise, was signaling at the same time that this was now the rate at which inflation would be able to be controlled. And so they are quite confident that rates are at or near the top in euros. And this, of course, means that for an investor, it's time to buy, because when rates start coming down, the bonds will mechanically go up in price. And so you want to catch the top of the wave and you know, be on the right side of it when the rally begins. And there's definitely signs that credit funds in Europe, which includes the funds that buy bank bonds, have been receiving a lot of inflows from end investors. So they've got money to spend, and they've been splashing it about in the market.
Okay, so this sounds ripe for issuers to take advantage then. And how have they been doing that?
Well, there's been high issuance in September so far. The month isn't over yet. There's another week to go, but it's still very close to the highest September issuance by European financial institutions in recent years. And the interesting development that Atanas Dinov and Frank Jackman, our financial institutions team, picked up on this week was something called pre-funding, which is when issuers basically bring deals to market for funding that they isn't really needed yet, that is sort of really needed in a future period. And what we're talking about really at the moment is funding for 2024. Now, big organizations like banks plan their funding in calendar years very often, or their financial years. They know roughly how much they plan to borrow in each year. But usually, if things have gone well 1 year and market conditions are conducive, they will start to do the next year's funding before the end of the year, just to sort of chip off a bit and sort of de-risk it and make sure that they have an easy ride the following year. Now, typically, that begins for financial institutions in the last couple of months of the year, maybe around the end of October. And, it will depend very much on market conditions. November is usually a decent month for issuance, but, nobody does much in December. So there's not an enormous amount of pre-funding. But what Atanas and Frank have found is that banks have already begun to pre-fund in late September.
Okay, so which banks have come to the market and how do they go?
Well, the two that have really caught attention are BNP Paribas and Société Générale, obviously two of the biggest French banks and therefore, among the top issuers in the FIG market. Both of them came to market this week with deals that were interpreted as being pre-funding. BNP Paribas printed a €1.5 billion 10 non-call 9-year bond on Tuesday, and Société Générale came a little bit later with an even larger deal of €2.5 billion in two tranches. And this was after, interestingly, a capital markets day at the beginning of the week, when the new CEO of SocGen, Slawomir Krupa, set out his strategy, and the equity market hated it, and the share price fell a lot. So it was a pretty awful week for SocGen and capital markets. But then they brought this very successful bond issue. The interesting thing is the strong appetite for these bonds. There's clearly unsated appetite among investors, and I think what that means is that other issuers are going to take the example of BNP and SG, and look at bringing forward funding that otherwise they might have done only, towards the end of the year or even next year. The one exception really is covered bonds.
So covered bonds are much more of a rates product than sort of bank senior debt. So what's been happening in covered?
Yeah, so covered bonds, which price almost similarly to SSA bonds. I mean, they're often AAA rated and have very narrow spreads. It's obviously still the cheapest funding banks can do in the wholesale market, but it's the advantage it gives some of them, especially the best rated ones over ordinary senior unsecured bonds, has diminished. And this is because the covered bond market has been going through some peculiar experiences in the last few years. It had enormous demand from the European Central Bank, which used it as one of the main sort of channels for its quantitative easing throughout the last sort of dismal years of low growth in recent years. And the central bank has now completely withdrawn from buying covered bonds. So the market's having to adjust to sort of basically doing without a huge investor. And the result is that the spreads basically need to adjust wider, and some of them have. But then there are others, particularly the German deals, where they haven't yet adjusted wider in the secondary market. And that means, when issuers bring deals to market, they often don't go very well.
So has there been an example recently of a German issuer sort of struggling a bit?
Yeah, there was a sort of good case this week with Deutsche Pfandbrief Bank, which is an unimpeachable issuer. But they issued a €500 million no-grow bond on Monday. It was a 4-year, so really nothing exciting or to scare the horses. But it got stuck at 27 over mid-swaps, which is where the bidding began. And the leads weren't able to tighten it at all. No order book size was given at any time, which basically indicates that it wasn't fully subscribed, and Deutsche Pfandbrief Bank had to pay as much as 12 basis points of new issue concession. So it was really sort of poorly received deal, and that just shows how the sort of dislocations that are still kind of shuddering through the market.
And looking at Atanas and Frank's story, it seems that syndicate officials are sort of suggesting that banks should go for senior preferred deals rather than covers.
Yeah, I think so, because they're just simply because the appetite in that market is so enthusiastic at the moment.
So the corporate bond market has also been affected by what's happening in the central bank world. And, you know, just like we've been discussing, it's been different to the rest.
Yes, so Mike, although corporate bonds are a credit product, rather, you know, like financial institution bonds, the picture this week's been rather different, hasn't it? And it's, we don't have a sort of massive issuance at the moment.
Yeah, we don't. It's been quite subdued after, you know, relatively heavy September, but nothing too big. But the thing that stuck out this week is that investors just want spread. They want to be paid for buying bonds. And if they aren't paid what they deem to be a high enough amount, then they they're happy to skip deals. And this is always true, but now it feels a much more, blunt hammers being used to drive the point home, because, you know, we've seen deals that on paper have sort of done most things right and just not got the result that you would expect, because that last element of spread was not quite there enough for investors.
So what do you mean doing most things right? What's an example of it?
So take Mobico, which is the new name of National Express, the coach company that we all took when we were at university, because you could get, you know, up and down the country for a quid. They were out with a 500 million euro debut, debut in euros. And, you know, they did things like they marketed it from Friday and then open books on Wednesday, so plenty of time for investors to ask questions and to do their credit work and look at the numbers. They put a no-grow tag on the 500 million, so investors knew there weren't going to be any, you know, surprises on size. They knew there was going to be that sort of tension there of scarcity of demand while still being a benchmark-sized bond, so still, you know, liquid on the secondary market. The maturity wasn't particularly ambitious at 8 years. So there's a lot of the things there, you know, tick the boxes. But then when the deal came out, the investor community saw it as tightening too aggressively from 190 basis points over mid-swaps starting point down to 175 basis points. And because of that, the deal only got 575 million euros of orders for a 500 million euro deal, which, you know, the deal got done and they tightened the spread and stuff, but that can't really be considered to be, you know, a great success, seeing only that much demand.
Were there other deals this week that went better?
Yes, there were, and generally they were the deals that offered, you know, significant yield. So we had Bayer in the market, the German pharmaceuticals company, and they were in with a hybrid, dual tranche hybrid, which by its nature is naturally going to offer much more yield than a senior deal. That deal managed to drum up at its peak 11.9 billion euros for a 1.75 billion euro deal. So you can really see the difference that having a high yield makes. Then at the same time, and this is slightly more subtle, but it's still significant, is Grenke, which is a German leasing company, and that has been, you know, through the ringer in recent years because it had massive short seller interest, and it was under investigation by the authorities over its accounting practices and had to reissue its 2019 results. So, you know, that's already starting off in quite a weak position when it comes to being in the market. It's got a story behind it, but they managed to sell their first ever benchmark size deal, which in the euro market is considered to be 500 million plus. This week they were clearly looking for size because they opened books on a 3.5 year deal at 8% and initially said they were looking for a sub benchmark size deal, so, you know, very much in line with what they'd done before. But demand was enough that they pushed it to 500 million, which is a benchmark size deal, which kind of opens a lot more doors. It gets you involved in indices, it makes other investors who wouldn't usually buy your debt interested because it becomes much more liquid and easy to trade. And this is quite an achievement for the company. And it's because of the 8% yield, which they didn't tighten at any point. That was a real standout and made people look at the trade who maybe wouldn't have otherwise.
Thanks, Mike. So now let's go to Victoria Teeler, our CLO reporter, and George Collard, emerging markets reporter, to hear what's been happening in their markets.
So, Victoria, you've been writing about CLOs this week. Could you please explain what a CLO is in as simple terms as possible for me, please?
Oh, thank you. Simple terms. Yeah, so CLO stands for collateralized loan obligation, and it is a securitization product that is backed by a pool of leveraged loans.
Great. And what's been happening in that market?
So what I've been writing about this week is that we've seen that investors make more of a differentiation between different CLO managers in Europe. It used to be very much that the European market sort of moved at one as one, and individual CLOs sort of priced on top of each other, and there wasn't much of a difference based on who the manager is. It was more important. So CLOs that came at the same time sort of were priced very similarly as well. And we've seen that change a bit over the past 9 months or so.
And what does the CLO manager actually do in the deal?
The CLO manager is basically the one who assembles a portfolio of leveraged loans and then issues the debt against it. So he's the middleman between the leveraged loan market and the investors who want to invest in CLOs.
So tell us more about what's been happening in the market then.
It used to be the case that in Europe, the only real difference that investors were making between CLO managers was based on the experience of a CLO manager. So if you're a new guy who's coming into the market and doesn't have a track record of successfully pricing and keeping alive a couple of CLOs, then you would have to pay a premium. But that just used to be a couple of small basis points. And there wasn't much other differentiation in terms of quality of the managers or so on. And the reason for that was that in Europe, the leveraged loan market is relatively small compared to the number of CLO managers that are there. So the CLO managers essentially all buy the same loans in the end, and all the portfolios look quite similar. But what we've seen now, especially this year, is that there is starting to be more difference. First of all, a higher premium on new issuance, and also the beginning of seeing more variation between pricing of CLOs even by more established managers, especially further down the cap stack.
So is this a sign then of the market maturing?
I think, first of all, it's a sign of interest rates rising and the market environment becoming a little more difficult. We spoke to one investor who said that, well, it was basically pretty hard to lose money for a CLO manager over the past 15 years. And the downside or the flip side of that was that it's also a bit difficult for an investor to tell if that's actually a good manager or maybe a not so good manager. And now, since we are in a more tricky environment, economic growth slowing down, interest rising, inflation happening, there is a lot more of an element where investors look at, so how is this manager managing risk and making sure that nothing bad happens to his or her portfolio. But I think you could say that is in a way a market maturing, because I think it's a good sign for a market if investors sort of, because if things don't all price the same, investors have more opportunity to say, oh, I don't want to buy yours, oh, I would rather buy this one. And there's sort of more opportunity to make money in more interesting ways, I suppose. And I think that could attract a couple more investors perhaps into market, because CLO market is relatively small still in Europe compared to others, and the investor base is growing, but it's growing quite slowly. And I suppose it would be good for everybody if a few more buyers came in, because that would ultimately perhaps also help the CLO market solve some other problems right now that it has, with spreads being really wide and a few AAA investors having a lot of power.
I wonder if you know the answer to this, if any CLO managers have had their nose put out of joint because they have found out they're not as good as they thought they were and having to pay more money.
I'm not sure if that's, it's, It's a bit hard to see that happening. It's a good question. It's not really that I know of anyone in particular, but it would also be a bit hard to see because if that happens to a manager, they would probably not take the deal to a stage where it's sort of publicly known that they're marketing it. But what we have seen, or what I have heard from people, is that sort of those who... big established manager who thinks they're definitely at the top end of the food chain here, if we're differentiating for quality, sort of saying that they quite like to see a little bit of tiering, and they quite like to see other, they might consider them lesser managers, pay more of a premium and sort of to be kept off the market. And they argued that this was, of course, only because the sort of smaller, newer managers with less experience and not as big a team might be more tempted to sort of put riskier loans into their portfolios. And then the investors might not have such a good investment experience if the performance is low. But I suspected that sort of what might also have been behind this is that we still have quite a short loan supply. And more managers means more people are sort of getting trying to get a slice of the breakfast of the big managers. And I could imagine, without that person having explicitly said, though, that that's behind it as well.
Yeah, so that manager isn't just charitably thinking about the health of the market in total.
I mean, I'm sure that's all he has at heart, but there might be a secondary component of that.
But that being said, there are still debut managers coming,
they
right?
Are,
you,
yeah.
You mentioned a few in your story.
Exactly.
So what's the market going to look like for them, do you think?
It's going to be quite interesting. So there's the pipeline, actually quite a lot of the names in the pipeline are first-time managers. We have Pemberton, who's marketing their first deal right now, although to be fair, they're a very sort of, they're a private credit firm with a really good reputation, so they're probably going to price, like, so sort of price discussions right now I heard are around 178 base points, which wouldn't be massively be above where, or outside where other sort of established deals has priced, but there's Sona and Arini and Carvel is apparently looking to do something, and it's going to be interesting to see how much of premium these guys have to pay.
And of course, you know, behind all this is the health of the CLO market itself, which hasn't been great, has it?
No.
And, you know, there's very low supply of leveraged loans.
Yeah.
So do you think we're going to see a meaningful increase in CLO issuance, and how can it actually get going again in Europe?
I mean, there is this sort of virtuous cycle that especially leveraged loan bankers like to mention, where a bit more, we have already seen a bit of a pickup in CLO activity in the past few weeks. And people, especially on the loan side, might be hoping that that is sort of going to kickstart leverage buyout M&A activity again, which would then lead to more issuance because there might be more demand for loans. But yeah, the primary market still looks quiet. There are sort of a few green shoots, I think, but people are still quite hesitant to make predictions about that, I would say.
I was speaking to a loans banker earlier this week, and I mean, they always sound quite grim and downbeat on their market, but this is taking it to a new level. I think this year has been really particularly slow. But as ever, they're a hopeful bunch, so hopefully it'll pick up soon.
Yeah. I feel like when you ask them about looking, like forward looking, they're always like, yeah, it'll be fine. There'll be no defaults. There'll be plenty of activity. It's just always two quarters away.
Well, thanks very much, Victoria. And we're going to be talking now to George about emerging markets. Hi, George. Nice to have you back on the podcast again. So you and Francesca Young, our emerging markets editor, have been writing this week about the effects of this rather interesting pivot in interest rate expectations for emerging markets. So how is that market taking it?
Morning, John. Yes, we have. So for emerging market bond issuers, there's a bit of a dilemma, which effectively is, should they issue as and when issuance windows pop up, as has been the case for the last 18 months or so, or should they start thinking about waiting until perhaps the second half of next year to issue any bonds, and when interest rates may have been cut? And on the face of it, that seems sensible because interest rates will be lower and so borrowing costs will be lower. But it's more complicated than that. Firstly, not everyone can afford to wait. If you have funding needs to do, you need to do it. You can't wait. That's particularly the case for sovereigns that have annual funding targets, and it would be a big risk for them to wait until the second half of the year to do it all.
So have any sovereigns been issuing recently? Or
there have been a few sovereigns who've issued in the past couple of weeks. There's been Hungary and Romania from Central and Eastern Europe, and the UAE issued a bond this week. I think for those sovereigns that are waiting for later into 2024, it would be a very small group. It would be the highest rated issuers who can afford to wait and who don't have large annual funding targets to hit.
And what are some of them?
I think someone like Saudi Arabia, for example, who issues, you know, once or twice a year normally, but their funding needs are not as large as other emerging market sovereigns on the bond market, and they do also have other ways of funding, such as the loan market.
And one might have thought that the riskier sovereigns, the sort of high risk countries with low ratings, might be some of those that would want to wait if they possibly could, because they're the ones paying the most penal interest rates at the moment.
Correct, yes, but I think the caveat to that would be that even if rates do fall next year, that they're not going to suddenly go back down to zero. These countries are going to be paying a lot anyway. So for them, I think the question is access rather than cost. And the risk for them would be that, let's say we get to September next year and they've waited, something could have happened that shuts the primary bond market and they can't issue at all, let alone at a cheaper price. So for that group, they just have to think about whether they can issue rather than at what price they can issue.
But of course, George, it's not just about rates, is it? Emerging market issuers have to pay large spreads over base rates, for example, if they come in dollars over US treasuries. And the way that those spreads change makes a huge difference to funding costs. So issuers will also be thinking about what's going to happen to spreads, won't they?
Yeah, exactly. And the difficulty for them is that at the moment, emerging market bond spreads are at some of their tightest levels historically. I think that point was illustrated nicely this week by the UAE, which is one of the best, if not the best, sovereign issuer, or at least highest rated issuer in emerging markets. That priced at a spread to US treasuries, a very tight one compared to most emerging market issuers, whereas Arçelik, a Turkish white goods company, which, you know, is a very different credit to the UAE, they priced on a yield basis.
But of course, both of them are ultimately thinking about the overall cost of funds, and the point is that if spreads get wider, then even if interest rates fall, they could end up paying more or not much less, right? So what do people think is going to happen to emerging market spreads?
Exactly. I think speaking to one funding official yesterday, he thinks that, or he said that it's a very high possibility, or a very distinct possibility, that if interest rates are cut and then US Treasury yields fall, for example, emerging market yields may not follow them, and so spreads will actually widen. And it's quite possible, and this was also echoed by a syndicate manager we spoke to, that spreads will widen quite considerably. And so, yes, as you say, that even though rates are lower and US Treasury yields might drop, the overall cost of funding could actually be higher.
And what do you think are going to be the factors that determine how spreads evolve?
I think the rate path is the one everyone is looking at. It's driving most investor thinking at the moment with regards to emerging market bonds. It's what all the investors we speak to talk about. And
so does that mean that if rates fall, spreads will fall too, but not reliably? Is that the point?
That's the theory, yes, is that if US Treasury yields fall, that's shows that investors are returning to bonds again, which might suggest that emerging market bond yields would fall as well. But US Treasuries and emerging market bonds are very different products. So there's no guarantee that just because people are buying Treasury yields, they're buying emerging market bonds. So you would hope that would be the case, but it is by no means a guarantee. And actually, the same syndicate manager thought it would actually be quite unlikely that emerging market sovereign yields would fall in tandem with Treasuries, so that if those Treasuries do fall after rate cuts, spreads will probably widen. And it's how much is the question.
So issuers have got to weigh up waiting for a potential rate cut, and or a probable one perhaps, and against what could happen to spreads that they'll have to pay on top. But there's even more uncertainty, isn't there, George, because of interest rates themselves?
Yeah, exactly. The whole problem that emerging market bond investors faced over the 18 months was firstly, when will interest rates peak? And it was, you know, it's been months now since everyone has been saying that interest rates have peaked and then they're waiting for cuts. I think speaking to one DCM banker this week, he made the point that, you know, months back, there was there were rate cuts priced in for September, yet now we are still talking about potentially another rate rise and interest rate cuts that won't happen until the middle of next year, perhaps. So this sort of peak rate horizon and then cutting soon after has been about to happen for quite a long time, and there is absolutely no guarantee that it's going to happen when people think it will. And so, yeah, the problem is that they might wait for rate cuts, let's say from the middle of next year, yet it's perfectly plausible that we get to that situation, get to that time, and that doesn't happen.
So rate cuts remain uncertain on their timing, and yet people are still going to keep waiting for them and hoping that they get the timing right.
I think that will be the conversation coming up. The syndicates we've spoken to, you know, it's when we get to October, November, that's when they start talking to their issuers about what the funding plans will be for next year, and that is what the question will be during those conversations. And it's a very different conversation to what we've had for the last 18 months, where it's simply been a case of, can we issue? And that's effectively it.
Ultimately, it sounds like what everyone really needs is a strong and decisive cut in US interest rates. And that will probably be enough to make everybody feel better, right, George?
I think so. But that has been what, you know, as mentioned, that was priced in for this month. Yet we're a long way away at the moment. So it's... Yeah. Sort of uncertainty over uncertainty, and that's just the worst thing for investors, whether it's emerging market bonds or any product.
Well, thanks very much, George, and thank you, Mike. That's it for today. If you like what you've heard, you can read more about it at globalcapital.com, and don't forget that the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms every Friday. See you next week.